If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet. Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the U.S.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, the Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation, Deep Space Nine. It's a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
Mail call, Adam.
Captain, I'm sorry to disturb you.
I'm receiving a code 47.
Verify.
It is code 47, sir. Starfleet emergency frequency.
Captain's eyes only.
We have a P.O. box. People send things to the P.O. box, but... Also, occasionally people will just send things to the MaximumFun.org mothership, which happened this week.
Oh, no.
KT, the office manager, I think is the only person at MaxFun that is currently going into the office.
Wow.
In order to make sure that the lights stay on and that, things run smoothly.
Can you imagine being the only person working in an office? The only one. That means all those sodas in the fridge are theirs.
Yeah, totally. So we got something from there as well. KT was kind enough to bring it by the other day, and I had a few things from the P.O. box piling up. So what do you say we get into these things?
Yeah, I want to see what we got.
I'm going to open this first one. It's just a plain old regular size envelope from Brian and Jennifer in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Brian and Jennifer have clearly sent us either a check or a bill. Let's find out which.
Dear Ben and Adam, just wanted to let you know that The Greatest Generation has helped remind me how important Star Trek TNG in particular has been in my life. In both middle school and high school, it helped me make friends when I basically didn't know anyone. Now, thanks to the pod, I'm finally watching Deep Space Nine through to the end after falling off in college. Please find enclosed a Trivial Pursuit Genius Edition card that my wife handed to me saying, "Send this to The Greatest Generation."
Whoa, when you read it, was it written that way? It sounded very intense just then.
Emphasis mine. It took me a second to figure out why, but when I did, I agreed with her completely. I hope you enjoy this fact that is tangentially Trek-related, but wholly relevant to the pod. So these folks have ruined their home copy of Genius Edition Trivial Pursuit. Let me see if I can find what's going on here. Okay, here we go. What does a man suffering from diphthalic tirada have?
Oh, is this the question that makes fun of me? Is this having to do with bowel movements?
That condition is the name of the condition of having two penises.
And there's our answer.
So all Klingons are suffering from diphthalic tirada.
Diphthalic tirada. Wow. You know what? With enough time, I think we could have put that together based on the root words there.
Yeah, diphthalic was a big tip off.
Right.
But we don't have time or headspace. This is a mailbag episode. These things take forever to record and edit.
Really glad that card is no longer in their house. Either put it down the garbage disposal or mail it to us.
Yeah, totally understood. Our next letter is a medium to small manila envelope from B. Cotton in Lafayette, Indiana. It's to Messrs. B. Harrison and A. Pranica. That's us.
Oh, I'm a messer, all right.
This is a letter that's been sent through the mail in a manila envelope that just folded the little metal hasp down on the back.
Whoa.
And that didn't lick the little adhesive strip.
I like that. A lot of trust in, and what did you call that? The hasp?
Yeah, it may or may not be called the hasp. I don't know. All right, here we go. Messrs. Harrison and Pranica, it appears I may have been too cute in trying to send you a brief note of, I forget now, but it was probably gratitude. Here is attempt number 2. May the USPS have mercy on its soul. And then along with the note is a letter that got returned to sender because...
I can see that.
Because the addressee for our P.O. box here was listed as two guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. And I guess the post office near my house didn't think that was specific enough to put in the P.O. box.
The postal workers in our country are under enough pressure without trying to do bits on them. So here's what I would say. No bits on postal workers for the foreseeable future, all right?
This is a letter that's been sealed with a wax seal and like a signet. So
Whoa.
That's pretty exciting.
It's not a bottle of Maker's Mark?
No. And it's a postcard with a cat doing like a shampoo mohawk on another cat.
I can see that.
This is written in cursive, and it's been a long time. Let's see. It says, Dear Ben and Adam, the artist's name is Pepe Shimoda, which is very close to Pepe Shimoda, which makes me wonder if Dr. Bashir and Jim ever crossed paths or crossed streams. Also, the painting brings to mind the halcyon days of the Star Trek hair cast, except it's hair cats. Wow.
I love it.
I swear it to Q, I'm sober, you guys. My personal situation doesn't permit me to increase my max fund contribution or purchase a P1, so you'll have to settle for this card as a small token of my appreciation for the smile you bring to me every Monday. Also, I'm writing this with a Newton Pens pen that I received in exchange for writing the copy for the commercial P1 a while back. Wow. I remember that P1. That was a really neat pen company.
Did this person just swear to Q? Did I hear
yes.
that right?
Yeah. But I think that's the Star Trek Q and not the awful cult on the internet that is trying to whip up the freaks of America into an anti-Semitic fervor.
The John Delancey Q, a lot more fun.
Significantly. Anyways, thanks again and much love, Ben Cotton. This is a lovely picture of some cats. So thank you for sending it in, Ben. And thanks for copywriting a P1 in exchange for a pen.
Yeah, thanks for that. Very cool.
That is a real power move to write a letter in cursive. I don't think I could do it.
Yeah, I think my penmanship at this point is very... I mean, I guess you could call it cursive. It's a bunch of wavy lines most of the time.
It's illegible in the way that much cursive is.
If I really want something to be read, I'm printing it out.
Yeah. All right. Next one is from Kids Keepa in Hartford, Connecticut, and it's to Uxbridge Shibota LLC. Oh, look at this. It says, thank you for your generosity of time and for bringing joy to so many people. Shana Tova. Hava and Josh, this is...
Shana Tova.
Hava and Josh are the hosts of Star Trek and the Jews, which is a podcast that I was a guest on recently, talking about being a person that did not grow up in a Jewish tradition, but participates in one now. And they have sent me a Star Trek yarmulke.
That's amazing.
This is awesome. This is just in time for the high holidays. And...
Are you going to wear it, Ben, for the high holidays?
Well, the great thing about the high holidays this year, Adam, is that they're all being done over Zoom, so
Perfect.
I shall. And inside is printed into infinite diversity and infinite combination, Star Trek and the Jews. They've even included a little barrette to clip the the kippa to my hair so that it won't fall off. Because
that's amazing.
Anybody that's worn a yarmulke for any amount of time knows that it might fall off and you won't notice that it did, because it still feels like you have it on your head for a long time after it has, you know, slipped away.
Wow. That is a danger.
That's so great. Thank you so much, Hava and Josh. Next package is from N. Brown in Rye, New Hampshire. And it's the TGG. This is like a bigger priority mail envelope.
It's got the bubbles.
It's got the bubbles. Dear Adam and Ben, this isn't a P1, so I'll try to keep it short, but I wanted to say thanks for all the laughs and single-handedly making me a Star Trek fan. Wow!
I started single-handedly?
Yeah, we did it.
If you can convert one person, Ben, really.
It's worth it.
Yeah.
I started listening to TGG years ago during the TNG days because I was curious. I got about 40 episodes in before I decided I needed to watch the show as well.
And I love that this person's curiosity lasts. Like, I was curious about drugs, so I did 40 lines of cocaine to see how that worked.
It only went uphill from there. I've enclosed a couple of things that I thought were fun. That copy of First Contact with a neat cover art, a story Nana Visitor told about auditioning for the role of Kira, and the only Trek joke I've ever come up with that doesn't embarrass me. Glory to you and your house. Nathaniel B. from New Hampshire. So, let's see. No pressure to read this on the air or anything, but I thought you would get a kick out of Nana Visitor wearing Docs and bumping loud rap music in the car on her way to her audition to get in character for Kira and maybe chuckle at my dumb joke. And then this says, it's from the Alpha Quadrant webcast, Nana Visitor's audition anecdote. She says, I remember going back and going, no, wait a minute, this isn't a woman's role. This is, because you got to think 25 years ago, what I was getting was, you know, kids get off the couch and sitcoms, really light stuff where you were the girlfriend or the victim of the killer. Nothing well-rounded, and this comes along, and I was thinking, wait a minute, this is a man's role. They made a mistake. And when I found out it wasn't a mistake, I was so excited. I remember I had a dark green shift dress, and I went out and got a pair of Doc Martens, and the Doc Martens kind of informed me where I was and who I was. I listened to a lot of rap back then, and I still listen to rap, but I really pounded it in my car on my way to my audition. And it was my prep for it. And I walked in, and I was fully Kira when I walked into the room. Wow.
Fully Kira.
That is a fucking great anecdote.
An audition's never easy, and it doesn't matter who you are. Like, it's interesting to hear that someone of her talents could still need to conjure an edge, you know?
Right, yeah. I mean, how do you get into that character is a question that only she can answer.
And I wonder if she's still got those boots.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah.
The Star Trek joke in question, to the tune of Lil Jon's Get Low, Deep Space Nine, damn she fine, tell her she can warp it to me one more time. That is a tweet.
That's fun.
So I read a tweet on the air. And here
is
the
VHS tape, huh?
Yeah, last thing in the box is the VHS of Star Trek First Contact. It's the kind with the hologram label where you look at it from different angles and you see different things. And it's the Borg Queen, Data, and Picard. And depending on the angle, Data and Picard are Borgified or not. And
depending on the angle, Lily appears as as the hero of the film.
As an important character in the development of warp engines.
Yeah.
Where's Lily's statue? There's the Zefram Cochran statue, and he's got his hand raised as if to the future. Where the fuck is Lily?
Yeah.
There should be a 10 times taller statue of Lily right, you know, like standing over him.
The Lily statue should be in front of Zefram Cochran, one hand giving Zefram Cochran the finger, the other hand pointing toward the future. Getting shit done.
This is the last package. It's from Bo in Rochester, New York. This is the one that went to Max Fun, and it says, care of Friendly Fire and Greatest Gen. So we'll see what's going on in here. There is a sub-package here.
Was that also returned?
Yeah, this is another... Oh, this went to the original P.O. box in Seattle, it looks like.
Wow. Yeah, they as soon as I closed up that box, they couldn't fucking wait to to switch it off.
Let's check out what's in the returned package. This has been in the mail system for years at this point. Got a piece of paper. It's to The Greatest Generation, and then parenthetically, the podcast about Star Trek. Hi guys, I found these in a shoebox and I didn't know what to do with them. I suppose you could use them or pass them along or something. I just got into the show through Movie Crush, and I'm still listening to season 5 of TNG, but I'm already a huge fan and basically can't listen to anything else. Thanks a lot. Wow, thank you, Bo. Movie Crush, our buddy Chuck Bryant's beloved movie podcast.
Love that show. Love being on it.
Yeah, you're doing a series on that show on your favorite director, P.T. Anderson.
That's right.
And I am doing a series on that show about my favorite directors, the Coen brothers. We're both regular guests on Movie Crush now.
Pretty fun.
What Bo has sent are a series of OG Star Trek cards. These are the ones with the like maroon border that are mostly episode specific.
Those are the cards that I spent my $20 bill from grandma on when I was a little kid. At the sports card store. That was a story I told very early on.
Yeah.
In The Greatest Generation.
I remember that story. Oh, man, there's the blue ones about original series Star Trek in here as well.
Yeah, get those out of there. When I went to that sports card store, I was saying, give me the next gen stuff, man. Keep that TOS stuff out of here. Got $20 here, man.
This is awesome. Thank you, Bo. Well... we have reached the bottom of the mailbag for today. I know that we have a lot of people in our email box asking for the P.O. box, and I will share that soon enough. I've got a big move coming up, and like the number of objects coming into the house really radically needs to be limited at the moment. But thanks to everyone that sent something in. Adam, we were almost besieged by mail just now.
Almost 558 packages came in during your last visit to the P.O. box, right?
What do you say we get into Star Trek Deep Space Nine Season 7 Episode 8, The Siege of AR-558?
Do you realize how incredible this is? No, of course you don't.
We begin with a scene of live band karaoke. Bennett, it's something I've never done, but secretly been interested in, the idea of being backed by a live band. This time, in the scene, it's Rom with a piano player doing a rendition of an old Vegas lounge song.
1, 2, 3, 4, 1. She likes the free, fresh wind in her hair.
Not a great singer. Is Rom?
No, he's auditioning to get in as the opening act for Vic Fontaine. And I mean, Vic Fontaine is artful in the way he lets Rom down.
Two singers on the same bill, that's a one-way ticket to Deadsville.
But we know the real reason why they're not going to let Rom be the opening act.
It's nice to be told that it's not the quality of your singing. It's that this isn't the act that we're looking for. And that's how Vic Fontaine lets him down. I need a stand-up comic or something. And this gave me the skin-crawly feelings because anytime Star Trek suggests the idea, even, of a stand-up comic, only bad and unfunny things happen.
Good evening, ladies and germs.
So I was like looking on either side of the frame for a Joe Piscopo to arrive, and luckily there was none to be found.
You made a living doing this?
Yes, I did.
That was very fortunate. Yeah, Rom is not going to be the opening act. He is told that he's not the right race, but the race that Vic Fontaine is looking for is hologram.
Rom is like ready to leave the club, and Vic Fontaine's like, no, actually, the exit door's over here. It's through the kitchen.
Fucked up.
Yeah.
Kind of a random cold open for this episode. Like, really, almost no bearing on what happens.
Yeah, it's a exit Rom, enter Bashir, who is there to collect a honey stick full of Vic Fontaine's greatest hits. He's going to, like, much like a person going on a road trip, you want to be ready with stuff to listen to. And what is suggested here that he's going on a supply run, and he wants a collection of Vic Fontaine's music to help lighten the mood for this mission.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that the Little D is a holodeck-free ship.
Dude, I was just going to ask you that, which is, knowing what we know about the holosuites and the holodeck, how do you make decisions on ship design based on, like, your hierarchy of ship needs?
Yeah.
I feel like holodeck should be a little bit higher than it is, because holodeck can do so many things for a crew, not just entertainment. Why wouldn't you put
it's
one on
It's not all jacking
D?
Off. Sometimes you need to make a model of the warp core from back when the ship was in the shipyards at Utopia Planitia so that you can make a pass at the person that designed it.
Total bullshit, man. It's just bullshit.
Sometimes it's fucking to make babies. It's not just recreational fucking.
Yeah. Sometimes you fight a turtle face guy. Sometimes you fight a skull face guy.
Yeah. It's interesting that there isn't one on the Little D. I get it. It's sold to us as a hammer. Like, it's a utility ship with bunk beds in it. Like, there will be no creature comforts here, but, like, there's more than one way to use a holodeck, you guys.
Totally. Yeah. Get your mind out of the gutter, okay?
And also, like, I wonder about their different sizes. Could you make a holodeck out of a broom closet?
Right. How big does a holodeck need to be effective?
Right.
It seems like the holosuites are way smaller than the ones on the Enterprise, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Anyway, we know it's Friday because Ben Sisko is checking out that week's casualties on, I think after seeing it several times, what is suggested is a sort of Vietnam memorial wall that just keeps growing as the war goes on.
Yeah, it's pretty grim. He is always in a bad mood when he's looking at this, and he gets interrupted in his reverie by Odo, who has some, you know, iPad of information to report.
There's a few casualties that aren't on the wall right now. I thought maybe you'd want to see these extra 40.
Breaking news, Captain.
Sisko says something here that I thought could have turned into bits for Odo. He says, like, you know, I used to read every single name, thinking that was the least I could do for the people who gave their lives in this conflict. Now they just blur together like founders in a lake or whatever.
Sort of like they kind of anonymize themselves, like one liquid going into another liquid and then becoming a part of that main liquid from before.
Yeah, it's just like a big golden pool of dead people.
Not a lot of Odo in this episode. This is the last we see him.
Yeah. You mean I got into my makeup for this one scene? Cool.
I'm glad you made me look extra sad this episode.
Very little Kira in this ep either. We get a radio call from her to Sisko at the end of this scene. The Little D, ready to go.
And go they do. Quark is going to be on the Little D for this mission and is quite upset about it. He's been asked to do some fact-finding on behalf of the Negus on the front lines of the war. And he is making, like, logistical complaints, but we know that Quark is a coward and he doesn't want to go be in danger anywhere. And that's, like, the main reason he doesn't want to go. But he's also saying, like, you know, my bar doesn't run itself. I need to be there. And Ezri is there in the mess hall on the Little D with Quark, telling him, like, you know, give me a fucking break. Like, you're the head of your entire species tapped you on the shoulder and asked you to do something for him, and you're belly aching about it. Give me a break.
I don't want to cut to the end here too soon, but Quark is my favorite character in this episode, and I think it's because of how his story arc begins. His very reluctance to be here, the suggestion that this is just a supply run, it's a very low-stakes thing, but still, like, yeah. What the fuck? He's saying what we're saying as a viewer. Why am I even here?
Right. I wasn't even supposed to be here today.
Right.
Right. I also like that Quark is doing this, like, the way Quark is dressed is the way Quark is always dressed, which is fancy. Mm-hmm. But, like, you know he's, like, going somewhere that is, like, not, like, he should have, like, cargo pants and, like, a mountain hardware puffer jacket on or something. You know? Instead, he's in, like, a waistcoat and has, like, a giant brooch on his chest, you know?
The scene transitions into one of bangers when a banger gets dropped on the little D, and the next scene is insane to me. So yeah. Quark goes out into the hallway and finds...
He doesn't want to be left alone in the unexploded torpedo memorial mess hall.
Right. He said he's got bad memories about that place. He goes out into the corridor and finds a very chill Worf just walking at sub-walk speed through the corridor. A person who you would think would be on the bridge during any and all bangers, or at least if he's not there, running as fast right. as he can to get there.
It made me wonder if Worf, as sort of the backup captain of the little D, like when Sisko's not on the little D, I feel like Worf is most often in the captain's chair. Is Worf like coming up to the bridge when he's not even supposed to be there?
Maybe, but I could not get over his lack of urgency here at all. It's not even super weird. It's not even speed walking. It's slower than you and I would walk on a sidewalk going to have lunch together.
Yeah, it's like, oh shit, wow, fuck. The ship might get blown apart. Well, I guess I'll wander up to the bridge and see if there's anything I can do to help. Who knows?
Have they stopped with the cloaking of the little D also, now that they know that their exhaust pipe gives them away? Do they not even try?
Yeah, I feel like there is a very vague sense that the Jem'Hadar can sometimes see through a cloak and sometimes not, and I never know when that's going to be a thing.
Yeah. Gul'dan Cut. So. Anyway, Quark makes his way up to the bridge with Worf, and Sisko treats Quark's presence like Quark is Cassidy Yates. A deeply withering moment here between Sisko and Quark.
Anybody here would like to join me in the mess hall for a Rattuccino?
Quark.
I'm just leaving.
And it's also not a great moment for Nog, who has a family member on the bridge potentially embarrassing him while he's trying to get work done.
But they do dispatch this tick, which just seemed to be there to kind of harass them. This is the Chintaka system, and Quark had the impression that this was like firmly under Federation control, but like he came to check out the front lines. What did he think was going to happen?
Yeah.
No combat?
Yeah. Not the case.
They are beaming down to this place, AR-558, with supplies for the troops that are stationed there. It's the Doctor, Captain Sisko, Nog, Esri, and Quark is the away team. One of the most scattershot away teams that we've ever gotten, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an away team full of Rudies, for sure. They really make up the Star Trek caves in an LV-426 kind of way. Like, right away, this is a place that does not look like fun. It does not look safe.
No, yeah.
And they basically, like, it's firefight already. They beam into a firefight, but it's Federation phaser firefight.
This really reminded me of the planet that the original Kai got left on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's like some of it is caves for sure, but some of it just looks like caves, but you can't see. Like, I'm assuming that there's sky in some of these sets.
Never forget original Kai, Ben.
Yeah.
Still out there.
Yeah.
Unable to be killed.
Being killed and then coming back to life periodically. Trying to make peace among those random cursed warriors.
Yeah. It's almost friendly fire here.
Yeah.
Before being given orders to stand down. among the Starfleet. They stop shooting long enough to realize that it's friendlies all around them.
Those are Federation faces.
The people that were shooting at them were frontline soldiers that have been defending this place. And we meet a few of these characters. We meet Vargas, who is the one that started licking shots in the atmosphere.
Who told you to open fire?
I saw a movement. I thought it was the Jem'Hadar.
Weren't you delighted to see Raymond Cruz here?
Yeah. Always delighted to see Raymond Cruz. Definitely cast for his Patriot Games energy in this role.
He's really carving out a nice Danny Trejo-like career for himself. Like, he's got a really good soldiery look. He often plays a soldier, but some of his soldier characters also, they have, I mean, they're fully colored characters and with inner lives and moments of comedy. Like, he's not just a one-note actor, but he does play very similar characters throughout his career. I really like his work.
That gear of a guy who has like been taken way past the limit of what he can handle is really good. And that's what he is here to do. He is, you know, 5 months into, you know, a stationing that was supposed to last 90 days max before they were rotated off the front lines.
90 days.
He is pissed. He doesn't care what your rank is and whether you know it or not. We also meet Nadia Larkin, which I wondered if she's any relation to the infamous Edward Larkin.
Makes you wonder.
She's the lieutenant that's been left in command of this place after the captain and commander that were over her were killed a few days ago. And AR-558 is an important site that the Federation is defending because it's got a Dominion communications node.
The only reason anyone gives a damn about this place.
And this was once 150 frontline soldiers that have been whittled down to like 40-something. And they've been just kind of marooned on this planet defending this site while engineers among them try to figure out how this communications node works and whether they can like start decoding Dominion messages that are being transmitted through it.
Besides monitoring devices you see here, you'll be issued every ultra-modern piece of equipment we have to ensure your safety.
The vibe of this scene is so instructive, right? In a way that a show tells you what it is early on and what its rules are. I was really blown away because, you know, what the idea is that this is a supply run and it may not be a big deal, even though it's behind enemy lines. But Raymond Cruz's attitude.
Take it easy, Vargas.
Take it easy? I would love to take it easy.
As fucked up as everyone is down there, the hard-boiledness of the entire scene, it really catches you off guard. And I think one of the aspects that is so uncomfortable about this location is how Captain Sisko treats the moment. And I really wonder, like, if you're directing this episode and you're directing Avery Brooks, it made me wonder if Winrich Kolbe dialed Avery Brooks back a little bit, because it felt like there is a scene and characters down here that would invite a kind of reaction that only Avery Brooks could give to things being very bad and desperate. And I don't feel like this is a great Avery Brooks episode because he is so tempered and neutral in an environment where it would be okay to observe and feel the kind of trauma that he's seeing around him. It's actually off-putting to everyone, all the other characters that he meets, I think, because he's so clean and from somewhere else and they expect him to be leaving. Like, maybe I'm answering my own question by describing him that way, but I could have used more Avery Brooks trauma because he's so good at it.
The story that they're trying to tell here is that he goes from the number of names of dead people has just become an abstract number to me in a way that, you know, like I feel like is understandable to me in a whole new way. Like when you look at like a coronavirus chart on the internet, you're like, fuck. Bad news, but it's not like it doesn't feel that personal.
But it's interesting that they save that realization for the end instead of beginning it right here, which it easily could. This is a fucked up scene and it's traumatic to witness.
Yeah, it's intense. We get to meet this communications array and some of the people that are working on it, including Will Robinson, one of the Starfleet engineers working on this played Will Robinson in Lost in Space.
Yeah.
Pretty fun.
This engineer begins a pattern of conversation with Esri Dax that makes me want to rewind the season and go back and play the Esri Dax drinking game, which is anytime a character asks Esri, are you a blank? And she says, no, but my previous host was a blank. You drink.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to die of alcohol poisoning by episode 8.
Yeah. Yeah. And at what point does a symbiote get to claim that they are a thing that a previous host was, is a question that came up watching this conversation, because she is the thing she's describing. She is an engineer. She is not was.
She seems like she's better at it than he is, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't know that his frequency discriminator was drifting. She did.
You don't want to discriminate frequencies in the 24th century. We're past that. All the frequencies are the same.
Infinite frequencies and infinite combinations. That's the way of the future.
To be quite honest about it, I was in a pair.
A fucking pair.
Mr. Bucket, I have to revert back to my latent state. I don't use the bucket anymore.
Elsewhere, Nog and Quark are observing another of the characters down here that we'll get to know a little better as the episode goes on. This is Reese, wearing a necklace of Ketracel white tubes as if they're severed ears in a Vietnam War movie.
Survive a war, you gotta become war.
Nog is super impressed by this, like speaks of it with covetous tones and, you know, considers all of these people, the 40 people that have been able to hang on here, to be heroes. And Quark is really horrified by these people. Like, he is... he's got, like, a very Hobbesian view of human beings.
Let me tell you something about humans, nephew.
Which is that when humans stop having nice shit, they revert back to a very vicious state of being, mm-hmm. which is is very interesting. Like, that, like, a very un-Star Trek idea, I think. But I think it is a very Ferengi idea. Like, Ferengi have, like this inherent suspicion of everyone. And I am personally much more a fan of the Rousseau view that human nature isn't inherently evil the way Quark seems to think it is. But
no, but deprivation can be a factor in turning people in a way that can be dangerous. And I found Quark's description in this scene something that I know I'm thinking about a lot differently in 2020 than people did in 1998.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, I tend to have an optimistic view of these things, that, like, in tough times, people pull together in my, you know, like, I think it's, like, much more likely that an institution engages in, like, horrific shit than a group of people that are faced with a challenge, you know?
Yeah, that's well put. I mean, this is you and I have talked a lot offline about just what life is like, what life has been, what life could turn into in the short, medium, and long term. And I found just even talking to you has been good therapy for me, because you are more of an optimist than I am, and that's it's been comforting.
It's interesting to have a character give voice to this kind of idea in Star Trek and have it feel authentic to the universe, because Star Trek is such a techno-utopian optimist universe. And, you know, I think Deep Space Nine is rightly cited as one of the darker Star Trek series, but I don't think it is in the human characters where its darkness lies. It's in the kinds of things that the humans confront.
Another aspect to the scene that I really like that is really elegantly done is the idea of a family member who is seen as a father figure, which Quark kind of is to Nog. There is some jealousy here. Like, Reese is a total badass, and clearly Quark is not. And he's seeing Nog appreciate someone else and look up to him in a way that, like, he knows he could not be that same type of person to Nog. And so I feel like there is a little bit of familial envy happening here.
In the caves,
Bashir is trying to kind of triage some of these soldiers. He's helping Vargas with some injuries, and Vargas has a bandage on an arm that Bashir reaches for, and Vargas reacts very badly to this, like to the point of holding a phaser under Bashir's chin and saying, like, you are never going to touch that bandage. And he explains, like, this, you know, a compatriot that fixed this wound up was killed immediately after putting this bandage on. This is like the remnants of his uniform that he ripped up to help me. And now he's dead and I have this bandage on and I'm never going to take it off. I'm never going to, like, dishonor him by taking this bandage off.
Keep your hands off this bandage.
When you've casted Raymond Cruz, I mean, this is the scene that you imagine using him in. He's excellent in this.
And I love how close they get with the camera in this scene. Like, it's as close up a shot as you get in Star Trek usually. Like, the ECU on his face as he processes this memory and talks about what it was like to, like, see a guy that he thought was kind of an idiot, but that was kind to him in a moment like this, dead on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real wounded animal vibe to this happening, and it's your proximity to these characters that makes it feel dangerous in a way that you're saying. When the camera's up close, this is hurting the Vargas character. Yeah. And even though Bashir's trying to help, it feels very dangerous for him to be so close to him.
And that pathos is so needle-pegging, and it, like, you see Bashir realize, like, oh, like, I thought we were, like, walking into a place where, like, other people that are also in this war with us need some help, and we're going to help them out a little bit. And he realizes that, like, the war has been much, much harder for these people, and he is kind of putting his foot in it, in a way.
Vargas takes Bashir over to the side, and he's like, the war is far worse than is generally known. On AR-558.
Fight does not go well, Enterprise.
Bashir goes straight to Sisko and is like, hey, listen, like, I know that, like, this is an important site, but, like, what you need to do is get word to Starfleet that, like, these people are on the brink. Like, their physical health is one thing, but the morale issue is not great.
Feels like the whole crew needs a kick in the ass.
Or a pat on the back, sir.
He is kind of in the middle of making this case when the first Houdini goes off.
Yeah, this is an introduction to the concept of a subspace mine, which appears out of nowhere. You can't scan for it because when a mine is in subspace, it's not scannable. So if you walk down a corridor and you're scanning for mines and there's no mine there, it doesn't mean there's no mine there. It means that a mine could appear there before you've arrived or after you're gone, and it doesn't matter. Scanning doesn't do anything. They just appear.
I don't know why
explode.
They named these after Houdini, because this seems like much more of a mine freak to me.
They name them Houdini because the mine doesn't explode. It flips you upside down, handcuffs your wrists together, and dunks you in a giant thing of water.
Yeah. There was a version of this mine that just made you sit in a block of ice in Times Square for a week.
No, David Blaine, no.
But it wasn't as effective.
Later on, Reese gets Houdini'd by being attached to a bunch of balloons, and he just goes up into the atmosphere.
Yeah. The Penn and Teller mine is another variant that tells you about libertarian politics for some reason, and you're like, give me a break, mine.
You knew the episode was going to drop a moment of choice here on Sisko, and that occurs when bangers are dropped on the little D while it's in orbit, and Sisko's on the surface. He's got to make a decision here. Does he allow himself and the crew to be beamed back up, or does he cut the little D loose for its own survival?
Pop quiz, asshole. You have a hair trigger aimed at your head. What do you do?
The decision he comes to is that the little D should leave and leave the away team behind on the surface. But big picture-wise, Ben, this is like leaving a general on the battlefield in the front line. Like, what is the comparison here?
Right, it's like you, like Nechayev.
Admiral Nechayev.
Kind of pleasing my ass. That's a Ritz cracker and chopped liver.
was never beaming over to the Borg cube to see if they could turn off power nodes or whatever.
Right, right. And it feels like Sisko is kind of a de facto belt buckle.
A totally sick belt buckle.
With how much control he has over the battlefield.
Right.
Right now. So it doesn't feel correct that he would either be on this away team or rightfully give an order for the ship to leave him behind. That, in an episode that I really liked, felt like a big clang in the logic of
it. I think that what they needed to do was just tweak a couple of things about like what the situation was in space. Like if it was
make it that they can't beam him back.
Like, yeah, it's a mega tick. If the little D drops its shields, it's done.
Yeah.
You know, like we got to bug out and he says, get out of here. Like we need to defend this anyways or something like that.
Get out and save yourself. Make the danger so acute that,
yeah,
that they got to bug out. But to make it just a choice that Sisko makes didn't work for me. Alamarin, come to Fort. Alamarin, come to Fort. What are you doing? What are you doing? Come on, what are you doing now? Exactly. He gives the order that they got to hold this position and they man the front lines, and Sisko starts trying to like scan
life
with a tricorder to see if he can detect Jem'Hadar trying to overrun this position. And what Lieutenant Larkin explains is that they can't detect any Jem'Hadar because all signals are getting jammed in both directions.
We jam their sensors, they jam ours, that's how it works.
Nog is the main detecting device that they have because of his big giant ears. So he's the person that they're leaning on to tell them whether or not Jem'Hadar are coming, and he can't hear anything.
I love the head fake of what the hell is Nog going to do here on a mission like this. This is fucking stupid too. Oh yeah, the ears.
Yeah. Well, the ears are actually super useful.
Reese is such a badass. He may be the most badass Star Trek character we've gotten in quite a while.
Are you nuts? I said, who's the all-time biggest badass? Not who's a dude nobody's heard about.
He's got kind of a Randy Couture quality about him. Like he looks like someone who did college wrestling. Like he does not have cauliflower ear, but he kind of has like a cauliflower head.
Yeah, he's cauliflower ear energy for sure.
Yeah. We get our first battle scene here not long after this where we're confronting Jem Halalograms who appear. And I think it presents a kind of paranoia that pervades the rest of the episode after this, right?
Yeah.
Like, is this real? Is this not?
I love the way they set this scene up, too, because the Jem'Hadar just start kind of like walking at them and they're not really firing back. They don't seem to be like trying to move tactically. They're not like trying to stay undercover as they advance on the Starfleet position. And it's just like, what are these cannon fodder ass Jem'Hadar doing? Like, shouldn't they be trying to win this fight? And then you realize that they aren't even really there.
Yeah.
The holograms were just a ploy to figure out what the position and force strength of the Federation was. And, you know, like they're kind of realizing this and realizing that they've been had when another one of these Houdini mines goes off. Every time they've got a scene where like they're like processing shitty information like this, it gets made even shittier by somebody getting exploded by a Houdini.
I love / hate this. Like, I love that it's an ever-present danger. I love that you hear the bangs off screen. Like, it's meant to make you jump and feel awful at the same time. There's this going on. There's a growing tension between Quark and Sisko about Nog being sent off on this mission. And I love how they're both kind of fathers in a way. And the question of whether or not Sisko would send Jake out there is raised in a way that feels very real. It feels like so much of Quark's character is like bitching to bitch about stuff and being annoying and doing things that make Quark Quark. But so much of his character in this episode is about asking questions that feel very grounded in the reality of the moment.
I bet you wouldn't send Jake out there.
Jake is not a Starfleet officer.
There is a new urgency around detecting these mines. And Sisko gives this job to Kellen and Ezri to figure this out. Like, how are we going to detect these subspace mines? And they get to work on it. Meanwhile, Quark discusses this situation with Nog and discusses how almost disgusted he is in Nog's behavior. Because
he kind of feels like Nog is Uncle Human a little bit, right?
Right, like he's trying to impress these people, and Quark can't imagine why anyone would want to do that.
Yeah.
Look at you. You hold that phaser rifle as if it were made of pure platinum.
I really like that Nog has never wavered from this belief in himself and his place in Starfleet, though, you know? Like, his closest family member is questioning his reason for being and his reason for being the way that he is in this moment. And he's totally committed.
Yeah. And Quark is too. Like, Quark is saying, like, if it had been the Ferengi sitting where the Federation was sitting when this had started, this wouldn't have been a war. We would have figured something out that was beneficial to everyone.
Yeah.
And Nog doesn't buy that.
When Nog goes out on this mission with Larkin and they find the Jem'Hadar training camp, it's clear that Nog is good at this. He's not just a punchline the way that he can often be in moments like this. Like, he's brave. He uses his special skill. He gets the job done. The mission is accomplished. But when the firefight starts, shit goes down in a bad way, and he's one of the ones that gets shot.
Yeah. Ferengi always hit that high note when they get hurt, don't they?
Yeah. I like how the sequence works, though. The fire descends on them and their mission, and we cut back to home base and their return. And Larkin's been killed in this firefight. Nog is put on a stretcher as soon as he arrives. And Reese does that kind of battlefield begrudging honor thing where he tells Sisko, like, how great he was out there.
You did all right.
There is a moment where Quark accuses Sisko of, like, not caring about Nog the way he cares about other soldiers. And Sisko saying, like, I care equally about every soldier under my command.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me kind of wish that Quark had been a fly on the wall in that opening scene with Odo, because I wish he'd flipped that shit right back in his face. Like, oh, really? Because I thought, like, 3 days ago you were saying the names blur together for you, and it's like, it's just a bunch of math at this point.
Like, that's a great call. That should have been called back somehow. In a you don't know what it's like kind of way. That I feel like is appropriate for a moment like this. But as it is, like, this is an example of Sisko absorbing and not directing his feelings toward other people.
Yeah. And being a leader, like, it does become math at some points for him. But I also don't disbelieve him when he says he cares about his soldiers. Because when he goes and talks to Nog, like, he is a great comfort to Nog.
Is the word given, Admiral?
The word is given.
Nog feels like he's responsible for Larkin's death, like he failed the mission. And Sisko's like, no, man, like the things that we needed to know were the things you came back and told us about. Like like the mission had casualties, but it was not a failure. It was a success.
Bashir tells Quark that Nog is going to lose the leg and that there are a couple of options on the table. There's lobotomy, just to clear the patient's memory of a traumatic event. It's what I recommend the most in cases like these.
We've already arranged for a family on Ferenginar that are prepared to tell him the lie that he was born without a leg and that he has always lived there with them. He's going to work as a airport security specialist. We've done this several times. It's kind of a playbook.
Yeah, I mean, and the reason for lobotomy is that there's no hope that the typical biosynthetic limb would take in a way. Because this is a nice bit of world building about the Jem'Hadar weaponry. Like, we know that there are things that they shoot at you that make healing the wound extremely difficult. And so it stands to reason that were you to get a leg shot off, that your ability to grow a new one would almost also be compromised, right?
Yeah, the Geminar fight nasty.
Morn.
Dear sweet.
Morn.
You near, buddy?
Morn.
Stop. Hammer time.
Ezri and Kellen have cracked the code. They, working together, figured out a way to tune a tricorder to reveal the position of these mines. And when they do, it is fucking crazy how many mines there are. They're floating all throughout the Star Trek caves. They look like they would be an awesome way to brush up on your lightsaber skills.
Pokey religions and ancient weapons are no match for a good blaster at your side, kid.
I love the cut over to Vargas, who has had one materialize like 3 inches from his face.
It's really well done, this reveal. Good job.
So we get the typical battle scene prep moment where somebody draws a diagram of the battle in the sand. This is Rhys kind of describing how the Jem'Hadar will have to get to their position if they're going to try and storm it. And Sisko has come up with the idea of moving these Houdini mines over to this ravine that the Jem'Hadar will have to come through to get to them. And there is like a moment of like, hey, weren't we just talking about how mines are like a really unethical way to fight a war?
It really puts the mine on the other foot this time, the plan like this.
I feel like it would be one thing if Starfleet like was manufacturing mines and laying them down places. It's another thing to like use your enemy's mines on them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And this is something that Ezri is the one to give voice to. She's got the one, she's got the second thoughts here. But everyone's like, shut up, Ezri. This is the plan. With 10 minutes left in the episode, I wondered at this moment, is this ep really about the mines? Like, is that what the episode is about? The mines and their use?
Oh, like is this going to become a thing about, like, I can't believe you used mines at AR-558?
That's kind of where I was at, because at first I thought this was an episode about the communications array, and then I very quickly pivoted into, oh, this is a episode about a wounded character and how it will affect them, and now it's about using a battlefield technique, using a weapon that you have moral issues with. And I'm seeing how much runtime is left, and I'm like, which is it going to be? What's the lane?
Yeah. I think it's an episode that's in some ways about all of those things. They get there. There's like a few minutes of tension in anticipation of the battle that is broken when Bashir turns on his honey stick Bluetooth speaker and starts playing his Vic Fontaine records for everyone. Slightly unnerving.
Yeah.
What the hell is that?
It's not a great season for Bashir. I think you and I can agree about that. But this turn into Bashir being the guy at the beach with a boombox is maybe, maybe the worst aspect to him.
We brought our kids to the beach today, sir. We don't want to hear "Pull Over That Ass Too Fat" blasting at 10.
Pull over that ass too fat. Pull over that ass too fat.
You know what this scene made me think of was that scene in Three Kings toward the end where they get the Mercedes limousines and they're escaping and they're out in the desert and Chicago's "If You Leave Me Now" is playing.
Yeah. Like,
that's the vibe when Vic's music plays on the battlefield. It's a stylishness to this incongruity that I don't think you often get on Star Trek. It's like college level stuff.
Yeah, and very late 90s stuff too.
Right.
The final battle really gave me Final Battle of Platoon vibes.
Yeah.
They are converging from all sides on our position. They are inside the perimeter now. We are like going to butting rifles up against their chins to fight them off situation. And a very terrifying image as Sisko hits the ground and a Jem'Hadar is about to shoot him and we fade to black.
That platoon description is so apt, because what is the score doing here? The score isn't doing war music. This is not like Conan the Barbarian music score here. This is like the Adagio
Triumph
for String score.
Yeah.
From Platoon, and that changes everything about how it feels.
What a lovely fucking war. Bravo 6 out.
To the episode's credit, you really don't know whether, when the camera fades back up, if Sisko's going to be around or not.
Right.
I mean, like, you're doing the television math, like, Sisko probably comes back next week, but I don't feel like it's a foregone conclusion.
What a bold choice to kill him in episode 8 of the final season. Like, that would have been incredible.
Seriously. So the prophet is, the emissary of the prophets is just dead?
From this point forward, Starfleet captains are really not permitted on away teams. I know it was like a policy that was a little bit flimsy that people like to break, but yeah. We promise this time.
Captain's prerogative is not an excuse anymore.
Right. There's an elliptical edit here, right? There's the blackout and the come to. And one thing we glossed over a little bit was that Quark kills a guy during the battle. A guy who rushes the infirmary, it goes off in this battle scene before we black out. And when we come to again, it's Reese that helps him up. Kellen's dead, which gives us like the counterpoint of the peaceful warrior is the one that dies. It's the battle-weary warrior that lives.
The Ring of Jesus fire.
Yeah.
Necklace of Jem'Hadar tubes guy. Made it just fine.
Yeah, and it's a Ben Sisko that doesn't really have feelings about his own survival, and very soberly like takes stock of the scene and is like, mission accomplished.
Yeah. Worf tries to gas him up about how great a battle this sounds like it was, and that is just not the mood that Sisko is in.
Yeah.
The USS Veracruz is arriving with replacement troops, and they beam out of there with Reese, Worf, and Sisko. Reese leaves his crazy Jem'Hadar knife behind. Not a sentimental man.
No, I mean, and if you were writing a film paper about this episode, I think you might consider this scene one of importance, right? Like, for a man like Reese to lay down his weapon could mean his life changes here. Like, maybe he never fights again. Maybe, I don't know, maybe a number of things. But I think it's a significant moment.
The button on the episode is in Sisko's office, where Kira comes in with Friday's numbers, and Sisko sort of recommitting himself to not treating this as an abstract number of dead people, and reavowing that he needs to think of each of these people as a whole person who is now gone from this world. It's a very grim, grim episode.
When I think about whether or not I like the episode, though, I think it really comes down to this moment. Because for it to have weight, I think you need to get with the idea that Sisko is a changed person from the beginning to the end. And I just don't want to believe that Ben Sisko ever thought that these people were blurring together and weren't individuals that had died during war. I don't know if the episode did enough to establish that he had lost the feeling of this thing. And were it to do that, I think his journey is more profound.
Hmm.
But I'm not saying I didn't like the episode, because I did. And I like that we get a hyper-realistic Star Trek episode depicting war as a horrible, scary place where, like, it's not romanticized and beam weapon heroic. It's, like, ugly and charred and scary, where legs get shot off. And, like, who is the one who lost innocence here? Is it Sisko? Did he have innocence to lose?
I think it may be Nog, but like this didn't feel like a Nog-centric story in an interesting way. Like it seemed like it kind of focused much more on Quark and Sisko than anyone else.
I wonder if moving the focus a little bit, like I know a lot of people praise this episode for going as dark as it went, to making the darker points that it does. But mm-hmm. I wonder if you don't get even darker by moving the focus around a little bit differently, maybe onto Nog specifically. But I think we're going to have future episodes that hopefully drill into that a little better.
That's sort of the promise of Deep Space Nine at this point, right? Yeah. Like if a stone was left unturned, you can actually hope for it being reflipped in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think on TNG, a character would get his leg shot off in one episode and then it would come back the next and there would be no conversation about it.
Right. Well, Adam, do you want to see if we have any priority one messages in the inbox to turn over?
We're definitely not going to reject that transplantation.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Ben, our first priority one message is from Savannah to you and me.
Oh, hey.
The message goes like this. Now everyone knows that I'm a little bit embarrassed to be a huge sci-fi nerd, but what this P1 presupposes is maybe I'm not embarrassed enough to keep myself from dropping 100 scarves on two awesome dudes that are also big nerds. Thanks for all the laughs.
Hey, thank you, Savannah. That is a super nice message. I don't know where you got those laughs, but they didn't come from us. Those must be misplaced laughs.
Right. Yeah, sometimes the viewers supply the laughs.
Yeah.
Not a lot of laughs in this episode as an episode of DS9, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt it felt hard to be a comedy podcast talking about this episode, didn't it?
Yeah.
We have another priority one message. This one is from Kevin L, and it is also to you and me, Adam. It goes like this. Thank you for all you have done to help support Black Lives Matter. I was unsure where to focus my efforts. I really appreciate you taking the lead and showing others how to help financially. You guys gave me hope for the future when I had none. Remember when you are down how your everyday leadership has already helped so many people. Oh.
Wow.
That's really sweet, Kevin. Thank you.
Yeah.
Kevin is referring to our fundraiser that we did surrounding the uprisings in response to the George Floyd murder that I think we promoted for a while on here and probably could do to promote more often. It's Friends of DeSoto for Justice. I think the short link is bit.ly/greatesttrek.
Those that have contributed to Friends of DeSoto for Justice have already raised over $70,000, which is really incredible.
Pretty astonishing. I am so proud of our viewers for doing that. That is just the most amazing thing. Well, thank you to Kevin and Savannah for supporting us. And if you'd like to get a message on the show, you can go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron, where it's $100 for a personal message and $200 for a commercial message. And we super appreciate all the help.
Gotta get that gold press latch. Get that
gold press latch.
Am I right? Yeah. Am I right?
Moms, can't live with them, can't find a great gift for them. It's madness. And it's the same every year. Mother's Day comes around and it's like, what's it gonna be this year? Another robe? Another candle? Slippers? A sweater? Flowers? We've got to do better than that, right? Well, you can. And it's actually the best gift you could possibly give a loved one. An Aura frame. Now, we have a policy to only do ads on our show for things that we actually like and use. And I gotta tell you, the Aura frame is probably the best gift I've ever given. Folks I've given an Aura frame to love it, and I love it too, because when you give an Aura frame, you're not just giving a person a bunch of old pictures, you're giving them new pictures every time you send one to it. Right now, Aura has a great sale for Mother's Day. Viewers can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com, and the code is SCARVES at checkout to show your support for the show. Terms and conditions apply. When I was growing up, I didn't have anyone to tell me about personal grooming. I had to learn these things on my own. So I'm here to save you some embarrassment and recommend the grooming tools that I use, the products from Manscaped. Now, this is a company that constantly has its mind on your bush. Imagine the meetings they have. Imagine the pictures they have in their PowerPoint presentations. Now imagine your junk looking its best thanks to the Lawnmower 5.0. This thing is the latest bunch trimming technology with two interchangeable heads, a standard one for taking just a little off the top, and a new foil blade to go smooth wherever your heart desires. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
I gotta get that gold press that.
Hey, Adam.
What's that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible. Drunk Shimoda!
We were talking about it before, just how unfunny this episode was. I think the only one having any fun might have been Rom. But even Rom didn't have fun because he gets the big letdown by Vic Fontaine. So I think I'm going to make my Shimoda Vic Fontaine.
Wow.
Who seems amused by Rom in this scene. Is made to let him down easy, and I think does give a big city letdown here in a way that only he can. So
yeah,
Vic Fontaine, my drunk Shimoda.
My drunk Shimoda is Worf for that scene at the end when he's trying to. I think he's trying to comfort Sisko, but there's a culture gap issue at play because Worf suggests like this was worthy of story and song, this battle. And Sisko's like, you guys pay for stories and songs with blood? What the fuck? And really flips that back in Worf's face in a way that I just felt so bad for Worf.
The Klingon jukebox doesn't take quarters, Ben. It takes blood.
Worf was just trying to help, man.
Yeah.
So, Worf is my drunk Shimoda.
Couple of good Shimodas. Do we have a good episode coming up, Ben? For that, I will ask you to see what's on the launch pad while I head over to the Game of Buttholes. Will of the Prophets.
Yeah. Well, the next episode is Season 7, Episode 9, Covenant. Kira is held hostage by her old enemy, Dukat, who has become the leader of a Bajoran religious faction?
Oh, no.
Yeah, I don't know how that happens.
Huh.
All right, Adam, I've got to roll a dice on a game. That game is at gach.biz/game, and it determines how we will be watching this next episode. Currently, our runabout is on square 22. Just out ahead, there is a banger, and I think we could also hit a Naked Now episode potentially here if I roll a 6.
You really need a big roll. We gotta make up some ground here.
Yeah.
Too many chutes, not enough ladders.
Yeah, this game is definitely based on chutes and ladders, but we didn't build any ladders into the game, did we?
Oops, all chutes.
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
Chula!
Did I win?
Hardly.
Well, Adam, I have rolled a 4, so pretty big roll. It's on the upper end of things, but gets us to square 26. Regular old episode next week.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to that. Looking forward to talking about more Deep Space Nine goodness with you.
Yeah. Looking forward to a Kira episode.
Yeah, that's really what I was getting at. I hope we have a couple of centerpiece Nana Visitor episodes in store before the end of the series. I think she deserves it.
Yeah, me too. Well, that will all be next week. In the meantime, we could use your help if you've enjoyed the program and would like to support it financially. I'd encourage you to head to MaximumFun.org/join and set up a monthly membership. You'll get all kinds of bonus content from us and from all the other shows on the network, as well as potentially, you know, prizes. I think there's like magnets and T-shirts and stuff in the non-Max Fun Drive part of the year for new members. Every new member is greatly appreciated.
We appreciate everyone. It's really a miracle to think about, to be honest.
Yeah, it's totally changed our lives, and we super appreciate it. You can also follow us online. We've got a couple of social media accounts under the tag Greatest Trek on Instagram and Twitter. Follow the Greatest Trek accounts. They're really fun to follow, and those are run by our good buddy Bill Tilly, the Card Daddy.
That's right. Part of the reason our show sounds so good isn't just Ben and I talking into these professional quality microphones. It's the music, and we love the music on this show. The original music made by Dark Materia, the updated introduction and interstitial music made by a friend of the show, Adam Ragusea, who's also a great big YouTube star. Go watch a video of his if you got a free moment. I don't think you'll regret it at all. He does great video.
No regrets.
Oh.
Tell a friend about the show. Give us a nice rating online. Check out our other shows on Maximum Fun. We got Friendly Fire, our hit war movie podcast, and The Greatest Discovery, our podcast about all the new Star Trek coming out. We're having tons of fun over there, and I bet you would enjoy that if you enjoy this.
Buy an ad over on Star Trek, The Pod Directive.
Yeah, advertise our show on our behalf. We're not going to pay for that.
Yeah, you already said you wouldn't. Well, with that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine, which I hope isn't one of our last times to lavish praise one of our favorite actors on this show. Love letter to Nana Visitor. Might be, though.
Yeah, it might be. Might be her last episode. Who knows?
Getting toward the end here.
Winding down. It's scary.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.